So I want to say a few words before we get started. First, to introduce myself. So my name is Aaron. I'm a postdoc here at the Perimeter Institute. I say here at PI, but I'm actually in my apartment, of course, because we're working from home. So sadly, we are not all together in the classroom at PI, but I'm glad to be here anyway to be teaching all of you. So like I said, I'm a postdoc. I do research in condensed matter theory using numerical methods that are, the stuff we're going to do in this course is sort of a starting point for what I do in my research. So it's something which I think is quite interesting, and I hope you will agree. And so I guess with that, maybe we also have a TA, so maybe she can introduce herself as well.
Hi, everyone. I'm Elizabeth. I'm a current PSI student in Perimeter's master's program. I have done, like, a lot of my research has been in numerical computational physics. So before I came to Perimeter, I did some relativistic astrophysics work. And then while at PI, I've done some machine learning and quantum many-body physics. So I'm really excited to help you guys out this next 2 weeks.
Great. Thank you. So obviously, if we were all in person, I would be, glad that I could look around the room and see everyone's faces and see, whether you're following what I'm saying, whether you have questions. That's going to be much more difficult in this sort of Zoom setting. I mean, I'm happy to see that many of you are sharing your videos. That's great. But of course, I'm going to be, staring down at this iPad that I'm using to write notes. So I may not be looking at your videos. So, if you have questions or whatever, I really want to encourage you. You should absolutely feel free. Just, unmute yourself and ask the question. You don't need to get permission or anything. Just go ahead and ask. If you want to, you can also type questions into the chat, although I may take longer to see a question if you put it in that way.
I can also monitor the chat while.
Okay, yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
So like I said, so please ask any questions you have. And with that, we'll get started. So I will be writing on this iPad, which should appear on your screens momentarily. Great. Okay, so. What we're going to be doing is discussing, as the course name suggests, numerical methods for condensed matter physics. So let me say some words about what this actually means. So the first piece that you may or may not be familiar with is condensed matter. So what I mean by that is it means we're studying many, many particles that are sort of all interacting with each other. So that could be something like a crystal and studying the electrons in a crystal, or it could be studying the properties of a piece of wood, or it could be studying liquids and water. Like, all of these things would fall under the umbrella of condensed matter. Numerical methods, what I mean by that is we're going to have some physical system we want to study, and it's going to be too hard to do that by pencil and paper. So what we're going to do is write a computer program that will help us to study the system. So our goals for this course are, one, to learn some numerical methods. So these would be things that will certainly be useful if you study condensed matter in the future, but hopefully will be useful in other areas of physics as well. And then two, to learn some important models from condensed matter. So in particular, we're going to be studying a model which is called the quantum Ising model. Or alternatively, the transverse field as a model. So let me write this model down. Okay, so this is the statement of the model, and my expectation right now is that most of you won't really know what this means. And so one of our goals is going to be to understand what this model is actually telling us, and how to turn this abstract model into a concrete math problem that we can solve. I'm going to come back in just a minute to try to give some physics intuition about what this model is saying. But first, I'm going to sort of outline a schedule for the course. And so we're going to go day by day. So in day one, that's today, our main goal is to cover some background material that we'll need for the rest of the course. So unfortunately, it means today is not going to be the most exciting day. But I think hopefully this will get us ever on the same page. So we'll be set up to do some fun and exciting things throughout the rest of the 2 weeks. On the second day, our goal is to, I'm going to introduce a method called exact diagonalization. And then we're going to use it to solve the Ising model. On day three, we're going to continue with exact diagonalization. Including, depending on how much time there is, and I'm not sure how much time we'll have, we will consider like, what is the computational efficiency of this method? How can we improve that? And then also use it to study a second model called the XXZ model. On day four, I'm going to introduce something called matrix product states. Or MPS for short. And then finally on day five, we're going to use MPS to solve the Ising model and the XXZ model more efficiently than by exact diagonalization. So this is our plan for the rest of this week and for next week. Okay, so with that said, I want to return now to this Ising model and try to understand what it is actually saying. So sort of what is the physical picture you should have in mind, and what does this model mean? So what I want you to picture is that we have some one-dimensional system. It's a chain, and it has atoms. Okay, so now I'm going to assume that every one of these atoms has one electron. And in general, it would be possible for these electrons to sort of move around the chain. Like I could have an electron that starts on site one, and then it moves to site two, for example. But we're going to say in our model that this is not allowed. The reason being that there's Coulomb repulsion. So that if two electrons were on the same site, they would repel each other very strongly and go back to being on different sites. So we can only have one electron on each site and they can't move. So that's maybe an assumption of our model. Then for each atom, we solve a local Schrodinger equation. So this is going to be like, you know, p squared over 2m plus v of r. And the result is you get some set of orbitals, like s, px, py, pz, d, whatever. And so again, we're going to make an assumption. We're going to assume that all the electrons are in the pz orbital. So as for why that is, that's sort of complicated and depends on the details of what, you know, what type of atom is it? Is it iron? Is it cobalt? Is it nickel? Like, that's going to change which orbital your electrons are in. We're going to assume pz and then forget about it. So you might think then that we have only one electron in each atom. We know which orbital it's in. So there's nothing else going on. That's the end of the story. But actually, that's not really the end of the story. So there's one degree of freedom that remains. Which is the spin of our electrons. So if you look at our chain here, we have like, you know, here's site I, and here's site I plus one, and both of them have a spin. And there's different configurations for these spins. So you can imagine that the spins are both parallel to each other, that they're opposite in some way, or that they're parallel pointing in the opposite direction. So these are, you know, four different configurations we could have. And our model says, the first term in our model looks like this. And so this SIZ, SI plus 1Z is going to be 1 for either both being up or both being down. That is, it tries to make them parallel. If they're parallel, it's 1. And it's minus 1 if they're opposite. So if we remember that, you know, when we see what nature is doing, nature always does whatever has the lowest free energy. Or in zero temperature would have whatever is the lowest energy. So in that case, because this J is going to be some positive number. So overall, to get the lowest energy, we want this SIZ, SI plus 1Z to be 1. In other words, this term in the model is trying to make the local spins parallel. Then the other term we have looks like this. And the picture here is that I apply a magnetic field in the x direction, like that. If I do that, then the lowest energy configuration is for the spin to point in the direction of the magnetic field. And the highest energy configuration is for it to point in the opposite direction. So the two terms are Hamiltonian. The first one is trying, this term, is trying to make spins point parallel to each other along the z-axis. And the second term is trying to make all the spins point in the plus x direction. And so when we say we solve the model, what we want to do is find, as a function of these two parameters, j and h, what is the actual configuration that's going to be the lowest energy state in this system? Is it going to have spins parallel? Are they going to point along x? What's going to happen? So that's really the question we want to solve. And that's going to be sort of the goal of the first part of the course, is to answer that question. OK, so before we actually get into doing that, we're going to take a step back and review some basic sort of background material that we're going to need throughout the whole course. So the single most important thing we need to study is the spin one half system. So this is something, something that is covered in most introductory quantum mechanics courses. And according to the survey that had all of you fill out, most of you have seen this before, but I still want to go through it very carefully just to make sure that we're all exactly on the same page and thinking about things from the same perspective. So I guess before I go into this though, maybe I should stop and ask if there are any questions about the sort of introduction to the Ising model. I'll give you a minute to think about whether you have any questions you might want answered. Okay, so yes, there's a question. What is the motivation behind the Ising model? And that's a good question. So there's, so this property, this term here, the fact that it tries to make spins point parallel to each other, that's like the simplest possible thing you can do to demonstrate magnetism. This is, in some sense, the simplest model that can represent something like a ferromagnet. Like, you know, a piece of iron that you stick to your fridge. So it has it captures an interesting physical phenomenon. At the same time, it's also relatively easy to solve compared with many models. So that's one motivation. Another motivation is that it turns out that this model has a feature which is called the quantum phase transition. So that's something which I hope we'll see clearly by the end of the course. And this is pretty much the simplest possible model, the easiest to solve model that has such a quantum phase transition. Any other questions for now? Okay, so let's move on then. We'll do our review of spin one half systems. So in general, the state of any spin one half system can be written as a linear superposition of two basis states. So we have two basis states, spin up and spin down, and we take some linear position superposition with these coefficients, and that gives us our overall state. And any state of a spin one half system can be written in this form, where a state is normalized, meaning that the absolute value squares of A and B sum to one, and this up and down forms a so-called orthonormal basis for the space of states. Okay, so one thing we want to check is the orthonormality condition. So what that means is that the inner product of any state with itself has to be equal to 1. And the inner product between different states has to be equal to 0, like this. OK, so that's what a state of the spin 1 half looks like. Now, another thing we can do is look at operators that act on this. So in general, in linear algebra, it's always the case that you specify an operator by saying what it does to every basis factor. So an operator O is going to be specified by its action on spin up and its action on spin down, which will look like this with some coefficients. So, you know, in principle, this is all we need. We've defined everything. But of course, we like to work with matrices and not just this sort of up and down ket notation. So let's write everything in the matrix representation. The first thing we have to do is we have to assign vectors to our basis states. So in particular, I'm going to make the standard choice that the upspin basis state is vector 1, 0, and the downspin is the vector 0, 1. So this sort of defines a basis we can use. And then once we've done that, we can find operators as well as other states in this basis. So I want to sort of take a quick interlude here and note something important about matrices, which there's been many ways of thinking about matrix multiplication, but there's one that I think is sort of conceptually the best. So let's suppose I have a matrix, well, I'll call it O, which looks like this. If I act this matrix O on the vector 1, 0, if you just multiply it out, the result is O, 1, 1, O, 2, 1. Which is the first column of O. Similarly, O acting on 0, 1 is going to be O, 1, 2, O, 2, 2, which is the second column. So in other words, any O can be written as O acting on 1, 0, that's going to be the first column of the matrix, and O acting on 0, 1 is going to be the second column of the matrix. So this way of using the action of operators on basis states to find the matrix is what we're going to be doing throughout today and the next 2 days of the course. So this is an extremely important way of thinking about matrices. So if we do that, let's find the matrix for this operator O that we defined here. So I'm going to find the matrix for this operator in this basis defined by this representation of states as vectors. So to do that, we want to find, let's say, the first column of O. So I want to act O on 1, 0. But I know what 1, 0 is, because 1, 0, I told you, is the ket up. So, but I told you what O is when it acts on up. That's O, 1, 1 times up plus O, 2, 1 times down. Now I can translate this back into vectors. This is 011 times 10 plus 021 times 01, or in other words, 011, 021. In the same way, if I act O on 01, the result is going to be 012, 022. And therefore, the matrix of O is indeed exactly what you probably thought it would be, which is this. So of course, when I wrote down the names of the coefficients before, I wrote them so that it would work out nicely like this. And this is sort of the best way to find the matrix representation of an operator, assuming you know how that operator acts on the basis states. Okay, so the next thing I want to say is there's some operators that are going to be particularly important. So in general, we care about permission operators. Which are ones where the operator is equal to its permission conjugate. Now, the permission conjugate of an operator can be defined sort of in the abstract language of states and operators, but it's easiest to understand in the language of matrices. So the permission conjugate is, of course, the transpose. And complex conjugate. So you do both those operations, you get the Hermitian conjugate, and we want operators where this returns the original matrix. So for 2x2 matrices, any Hermitian operator can be written as like this. So I think you probably most of you have seen these before. We have, of course, the identity matrix, and then the three so-called Pauli matrices. So now I was saying before that the real physical object is an operator. So that's, you know, this O, which is defined by how it acts on the basis states. So now I've written these as matrices, but I want to rewrite them in the language of states and operators, not in the language of matrices. So to do that, I should remember, let's look at like sigma z for an example. So sigma z acting on the state up is going to be sigma z acting on 1, 0, because that we've assigned 1, 0 to up. And now this operation I can do because sigma z acting on 1, 0 gives me the first column of the matrix for sigma z. And that, of course, is equal to up. So, okay, again, this is very simple in this case, but I'm writing out all the steps because we're going to be using these same steps later for much more complicated operators. So it's important to sort of make sure you know the right steps to follow when you're in a more complicated situation. So if I do this same sort of procedure for all these four operators, I'm going to get the following result. Okay, so I put a box around this because I really want to emphasize how important it is. This matrix representation is nice, and in practice, we'll be using it most of the time. But what I put in the box is really the definitions of these operators. So these definitions apply no matter what basis I choose in order to write my matrices. But I can choose a basis in which the matrices actually look quite different. Okay, so I guess this is sort of the next sort of natural stopping point where I'd like to see if there are any questions and before I move on. Okay. Well, if there are no questions, then I want to actually demonstrate the fact that I just told you, which is that these definitions, in terms of the sort of fundamental states and operator picture, can lead to very different matrices. So we're going to try to find our matrices in a totally different basis. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to define two new states. I'm going to denote this one by right arrow, which is an equal superposition of spin up and spin down. And then I'm going to define by left arrow a different equal superposition, but it has a minus sign. So I claim this is another valid basis. So the first thing we want to do is check that it actually is a valid basis. So that means, for example, that I want to know that this is equal to 1. So that's something we can work out. This is equal to 1 over root 2 times up plus down adjoint. Okay, if we can write this out, it has four terms, which look like this. And we know from before that these are equal to 1, 0, 0, and 1. So indeed, this is true, so this vector is indeed normalized. Right, and then we can also check, I'm not going to write this one out, but we could check, for example, that the vectors are orthogonal, that this inner product is 0, for example. So that's something which you can do on your own if you want to, but we're going to assume that's true. Okay, so now we can actually check, find what are these matrices. So we're going to find the Pauli operators in this new basis. So how do we do that? We're going to follow our general procedure. So let's look at sigma z, for example. I've skipped a step. Let me go back. Briefly to correct this. So I'm going to, in my new basis, I'm going to call this state 1, 0 and this state 0, 1. That's, of course, very important. I have to actually assign what my vector is to states. So this is the definition of my basis. Okay. So the first column of our new sigma z matrix, that is sigma z in the new basis, is going to be sigma z acting on what I'll call 1, 0, nu. So let's do that. Let's write that out. So sigma z acting on 1, 0, nu is going to be sigma z acting on 1 over root 2 times up plus down. And I can distribute the sigma z, because of course it's a linear operator, and I get this. Now, I can act sigma z on the two basis states using my known definitions of the operator. And I get 1 over root 2 times up minus down. So now if I sort of scroll up over here, you can see that that is exactly the second basis state. which I called 0,1 in the new basis. So this is equal to 0,1 new. Okay, and if you want to get the second column, that's sigma z acting on 0,1 new. And if you do the same sort of steps, eventually you'll find that that's equal to 1,0 new. So what that means is that sigma z in this new basis is equal to 0,1,1,0. So in fact, in this basis, sigma z has the same matrix that sigma x had in our original basis. So I want to emphasize again, this sigma z is the same sigma z. It just happens to have a different matrix because we're in a new basis. All right, so I think that sort of it would be good to make sure we're all keeping up here. If you can do a little bit of a quick practice exercise. So I'm going to have you take about 5 minutes. It might be faster, but you can take 5 minutes to find sigma x nu and sigma y nu using the same sort of procedure. So you're going to take a few minutes and work on that right now. This is also a good opportunity. Again, if you have any questions, now would be a good time to ask. Okay, so I think what you should have found is that in the new basis, the operators look like this. So of course, I've written already the sigma z, which is 0,1,1,0, and sigma x is 1,0,0 - 1. Sigma y should be 0,i - i, 0. So what I want you to notice here is that sigma x and sigma z have swapped compared to the old basis, right? So what we've actually done, these states might be referred to as the z eigenstates, because in that basis, sigma z is diagonal, and these two states are the x eigenstates, because in this basis, sigma x is diagonal. Okay, so what I want to do now is sort of give a different method of doing a change of basis. This is not going to be strictly necessary for purposes of the rest of this course, but it's something which I want to do just because I think it's a deficiency in most linear algebra classes, how they discuss change of basis. So I want to teach you something which I hope that many of you will find useful. So again, our goal, I'm going to use sigma z as an example. Our goal is, given the matrix for sigma z old, we want to find the matrix sigma z nu. Okay, so we have our procedure that we're going to use. So let's suppose we want to find what is column 1 of sigma z nu? This is a question we want to ask, and we want to find a matrix way of answering this question. So the answer, of course, is that just what we've been doing, it's going to be the image of the vector 1,0 nu, right? But we know how to apply sigma z to the vectors 1, 0 old and 0, 1 old. That's what the old matrix tells us. So the first thing we want to do is we want to take 1, 0 new, and we want to turn it into some matrix, some vector that's in the old basis. And then we're going to apply sigma z old, which is the matrix we already know, and get some new vector. And then we're going to transform it back into the new basis. And this C comma D is going to be the first column of sigma z nu. OK, so it turns out that these transformations are done by matrix multiplication. In particular, let's look at this one. So I want to turn, I want a matrix that takes 1, 0 new and tells me what it is in the old basis. Right? But I know that the image of 1, 0 new is going to be the first column of the matrix. That's our rule, right? First image of 1, 0 is the first column. So the matrix that does this is going to have whatever this 1, 0 new turns into in the old basis as the first column. Okay, but we've done this before, right? So 1, 0 new is this, which is up plus down, which is 1, 1 over root 2. So that's going to be the first column of my matrix. Similarly, if I apply it to the second basis vector, what I'll get is 1 minus 1 over root 2. I guess I should write that this is old. So that implies that our transformation matrix is 1, 1, 1 minus 1 over root 2. OK, so then we also wanted to find this sort of opposite transformation. But of course, if you have any function, if you want to do the opposite function, you just take the inverse. OK, so in general, finding the inverse of a matrix is pretty annoying. But any matrix whose columns are orthonormal vectors is unitary. Which means that to get the inverse of the matrix, all we need to do is take the Hermitian conjugate. And in particular, that means that the inverse of this matrix is itself. So to summarize this, our new matrix is found by taking the old matrix and then what we call conjugating it, meaning we put another matrix on both sides of it by this transformation matrix. And so again, the way you think about this is there's sort of steps. So you first put in a vector in your new basis, And when you put it through the machine that is this 1, 1, 1, minus 1 matrix, the result is the vector in the same vector in your old basis. Then you put it through the next step. The result is sigma z applied to the vector in the old basis. And then you put it through this step, and you get back sigma z applied to your vector in the new basis. And so I think in pretty much any linear algebra class, you've probably seen a change of basis formula. So that's what this is. Now, what I've tried to make clear is where this comes from. That you want to basically, this is turning old vector, is writing your new vector in the language of old vectors, and then this does the opposite transformation. This does the writes the old new vector in terms of the old vectors. This writes your sigma z applied to your vector in the old basis in the new basis. Okay, so I'm not sure exactly how clear that is. So again, I want to say this is a good time to ask some questions if you have them. So I'll give you, a minute to do that. And in the meantime, what I want to do now is to do some programming exercise. So of course, for the rest of this course, we're going to be doing quite a bit of numerical work, meaning programming. And I prepared sort of a very simple programming exercise that will hopefully make sure we're all ready to work on more sophisticated programs later on. So I believe you all had this Google Drive folder shared with you. So if you go to the folder for this course, in addition to the course outline, there's another document there, which is called numpybasics.ipynb. So actually, if there aren't questions about the change of basis thing, then I'm going to switch my screen sharing over to my desktop so I can show you sort of the folder and the program. So I guess let me know now if there are questions, and otherwise I'm going to do this switch. Okay, so I guess I'm gonna switch now. Maybe this is what I want. Okay, right. So you should have this folder here. So this is the file I'm talking about. So I want you to download this and somewhere where you can run it from your computer. If you don't want to download it, you can also open it with what's called Google Collab. So if you right-click it, you should have an option that says Open With, and you can select Google Collaboratory. That will let you run it in your browser as well. So it's up to you whether you want to use that option or as the so-called Jupyter Notebook. So if you're going to use Jupyter Notebook, then I just need to tell it to share that. So let me share. So you have a command prompt. You can go to the drive to make sure you're in the right drive, but then you just type in your command prompt or terminal Jupyter Notebook and run it. And it will start up this Jupyter Notebook in your internet browser. So I think you should be able to see that now. So here I've stored my file here, which is numpybasics.ipynb. And I can go ahead and open it, and I get something like this. So this is called an IPython notebook. So I guess now I want everyone to sort of get this open and make sure that it's you have this available to work on. So if you, I'm going to give you like, you know, let's say 2 minutes from now to sort of get this up and running. And then if you have trouble with it, you should let me or Elizabeth know and we can help you get this set up. Right, so okay, that's a question about how to open it using Jupyter. So you have to download it first, and then you can type type in a terminal window. So if you're on Windows, that would be command prompt. If you're on Linux or Mac, it would just be terminal. And you type Jupyter notebook. I've just put that in the chat so you can see it. And then once you have Jupyter Notebook open, you can navigate to whatever file folder you stored the program, and you can open it from there. Ah, yes, that's a very good point. Yes, Elizabeth has pointed out that you don't want to change the master copy, that this is a very good thing to point out. Okay, so I'm going to assume now that everyone has this open and running, I think. Oh, okay, somebody is having trouble still. So maybe if you can ask Elizabeth to help you, so I can sort of get started talking about this. I'm worried about the time, but so if you can send a private message to Elizabeth to get help, that would be great. Okay, so I'm going to start talking about what I have here. So for now, you can just look at my screen, and I'll go through the top part of the program. Talking it through with you, and then there's exercises in the second half for you to work on and fill out. And for that, we'll break into small groups, and you can work on it talking with each other to work through it. So here I've just written sort of a summary of what we already talked about. I've defined the same operators. Here are the matrices for them in this up-down basis. Okay, it looks like there's still some issue. Apparently people can only send private messages to me, is that true? Okay, so actually, if several people are still having this problem, host and co, that's okay, that's a good point. So maybe I can make Elizabeth co-host of the meeting, let's see. Okay, so I made Elizabeth a co-host now, so hopefully you can write some messages and she can help you get set up. Okay, so for those of you who have this open, if you can, so look at where my cursor is. So this is the first line of the actual program. And so what we're doing here, for those of you who haven't used Python before, is we're importing a package called NumPy or numerical Python, which contains a bunch of functions that we're going to be using. So you can press Shift Enter to run it. And that will just import this package so that you have these functions available to use. Then in the next line of code, we're going to create a matrix. So the way we do this is with this function called array from the NumPy package. So this, you see it says np dot. That dot means that everything that comes after it comes from this NumPy package. It comes from the thing before the dot. Then whatever's inside these parentheses is passed into a function called array, which is going to take the input and generate a matrix object. And what I'm passing in, you can see this 1, 0 in brackets, that's the first row of the matrix. This 0, 1 in brackets is the second row of the matrix. And then I put it in sort of another set of brackets to indicate the edges of the matrix. So this is going to generate a matrix that looks like 1, 0, 0, 1. That is the identity matrix. And it's going to store it in this variable called ID or identity. So we can access, so let me run this one by pressing Shift Enter. Now that this variable has been stored, if we go to the next line, it just says ID. And if I press Shift Enter, now you can see it prints out array 1, 0, 0, 1. So that's the value of this variable ID. It stored this matrix, which the identity matrix. So we can also explicitly tell it to print something. So with this function that's print, and then you put parentheses, and whatever is inside the parentheses gets printed, like this. And we can also print specific words if we want to. Like here, I put some apostrophes, and here I put quotation marks around the letters ID. So that's just going to print out the letters ID. It prints out whatever is inside the apostrophes or quotation marks. And doesn't use the variable. You can also combine them like this. If I put a comma here, then it'll print both the thing that's before the comma and the thing that's after the comma. And you can print as many things as you want in one statement. So if I run this, the first two just print text that says ID. The third one says ID colon. That's the text I put in. And then it prints the matrix. OK, so here's another example matrix, which is the sigma y matrix. So this looks like 0 minus I, 0. And we represent I by the symbol 1j. So that's, I mean, to me, that feels weird, but I guess that's normal in engineering. But in any case, if we run this, we can see we've got our matrix that has 0 minus I, 0, which is the SY matrix. All of these matrices also store their variables in a certain, what's called a type. So if you look at the identity matrix, it just has 1, 0, 0, 1 in it. Those are all integers. So if I do id.dtype, it'll tell me that it's made out of integers. This sy has a complex number, 1j. So if I do sy.dtype, it'll tell me that it's a complex number. So you see it says id matrix dtype is int 32, that's an integer. And sy matrix dtype is complex 128, that's a complex number. So we can also define vectors like this. So here, instead of having a double set of brackets, I just have one set of brackets. That's because I only need one list. So the identity matrix, I kind of have this nested list. Like the first, the outer brackets make a list of the rows. And then for each row, I have a list. Here, I just only have one dimensional thing. So I just only have one set of brackets. OK, so this is what I wanted to demonstrate for you before you go and look at this. But in the rest of this file, I put together some exercises for you to work on. And that's what we're doing for basically the rest of this class session until the very end when we'll come together and I'll show you the answers. So what I've asked you to do is to first follow the examples I've put in to generate matrices for SX and SZ, as well as for the second basis vector, E2. Then I've written some descriptions of things that you can do with matrices in Python. And then we're going to use them to do some various exercises, such as checking that all the polymatrices are Hermitian, checking that each polymatrix squares the identity, checking the eigenvalues of every polymatrix, and then checking these relations, which are part of the commutation relations for these matrices. So we're going to be doing that numerically. Here's, I put an example for one of these exercises using SY. And then we're also going to rewrite this using what's called for loops. If you haven't done a lot of programming, I think most people have probably seen this, but basically we're going to make a new variable called m. And every time we go through, for every item in this list after in the for loop, I set m equal to whatever is here. So in this case, like sx. And then I do this, I run all the code that's been indented under the for loop for every value of m, which is in this list. So I'm going to first run it for sx, and then for sy, and then for sz. Then we're going to have an exercise where we're going to show that other projections of the spin operator also have the same eigenvalues. So we're going to use some arbitrary unit vector n and dot it with the vector sx, sy, sz, and show that it has the same eigenvalues as sx, sy, and sz individually. And then finally, we're going to do this change of basis that we saw, we did by hand in your previous exercise, and you're going to use Python with this change of basis matrix to do that change directly in very quickly using this calculator.
So do we just directly assign theta and phi as whatever we want?
Yes, that's right. So theta and phi, you can make whatever you want. And so the goal of the exercise is to show that, you know, you can change theta and phi around and the eigenvalues won't change.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide you all up into these Zoom breakout rooms. And my hope is that you'll work on these exercises together and sort of, you know, talk to each other. You'll be able to share your screens with each other so you can, you know, show each other what codes you're working on. So I hope you'll take advantage of that. And to facilitate that, I think that the right thing to do would be when you first enter your room, if you can all introduce yourselves to each other and get to know each other for a minute, I think that would be a very good thing. So let me generate these things. Okay, so I think that looks good. Let me swap. Okay, so I'm going to send you all to these breakout rooms now, and then Elizabeth and I will both start in one of the rooms somehow, and then we'll move around and check in on how all of you are doing. So go ahead and join the breakout rooms now, and we'll come back together after working on these exercises. All right, so it looks like everybody is back in the main room now. So I want to just to finish out today's class, go through the exercises and make sure that everyone knows how to do them. So to start with, we're just entering in these matrices. So we're just following the examples from above. We first put in row one, in this case for SX, which is 0, 1. Then we put in row two for SZ, which it is 1, 0 in the first row, and 0, minus 1 in the second row. And E2 is going to be just the vector 0, comma 1. So those are now defined. And now we're going to do these exercises. So for each of the matrices, we want to do these checks here. So the first one is to check that each of the matrices is Hermitian. That is, its conjugate transpose is equal to itself. So we can just copy and paste what I have already done, like this. So SY, we just change SY to SX. And similarly, we can do the same thing, change it to SZ. And if I run this, you'll see that all of these are true. So that's good. We've done number one. For number two, we're going to check that each poly matrix squares the identity. So we're going to do the same kind of thing. But instead of checking that sz.conj.transpose minus sz is close to 0, what we're going to do is let's check like SZ, at symbol SZ. So this at symbol does matrix multiplication. So this is SZ squared minus ID should be less than 10 to the minus 12. That is saying that the difference between these matrices is very small. And of course, we can do the same thing with X and Y. And you see, okay, that also returns true, so that's good. That check also passed. We also want to check the eigenvalues and eigenvectors with the np.linalge.eig function. So we can do that with sx, sy, and sz. And if I go ahead and run this, you can see that each one, first thing I get is this 1 minus 1, so that's the eigenvalues that we expected. And then here is an array containing the eigenvectors. For right now, we don't care about those. And then we also did this with sy. And again, we get 1 and minus 1. They now have this 0 j attached to them because the matrix was imaginary, so it returns imaginary eigenvalues, even though the imaginary part is actually 0. And then with sz, we again get this 1 minus 1. So we got the correct eigenvalues in every case. The final thing we wanted to check was these relations that like sx times sy is equal to isz. So we can do those checks again with this kind of code. So first I'm going to multiply sx with sy and check that it's equal to 1j times sz. Similarly, we can do sy sz and check it's equal to 1j times sx. And I can do sz times sx and check that it's equal to 1j times sy. And you can see, again, these are all true. So their checks all passed. OK, but now this is pretty inefficient because as you can see, I sort of like wrote the same thing three times in all of these. So that's the point of doing this for loop is we set m equal to these different matrices. And we can only have to write it once. So I did the first one already, checking this m.conj.transpose is equal to m. Another thing we can do is the square being equal to identity. So in this case, we just replace m, sz by m, which will be equal to sx, sy, and sz on subsequent loops through this code. And then finally, we're going to do this eigenvalue check. So again, we just replace the matrix by m, and it will automatically do it for sx in the first block, and then sy in the second block, and sz in the third block. OK, so the last one, here there was a bit of an issue, which I didn't realize when I was first writing this, which is that you can't use the np.dot function in this step. So I'll show you what to do, and then I'll show you the function that does work. But we won't be actually talking about how to use that function until sometime next week. But let me just put in some random stuff here. So let's do theta is 0.123. This will do 0.456. So there's random numbers. And then we're going to make our vector n. So np.array. Let's put in our vector. So the first component is np.sine of theta times np.cos of phi. And then we got np.sine of theta times np.sine of phi and np.cos of theta. So that's my vector n. Now sn, here what we're going to have to do is like this. So that will certainly work. So I can run this code. OK, well, actually, I made a mistake. What did I do? I misspelled theta. Great. OK. So now you can see that, indeed, our eigenvalues that we got with these random theta and phi are 1 and minus 1. So now I want to comment briefly on this mistake that that I made in writing this, because I thought you could do this. And that doesn't work because I think a lot of you tried to do this and you got this error that says the shapes don't match, the dimensions don't match, because this is a vector with size 3 and this is a tensor with rank size 3 comma 2 comma 2. Okay, so there's kind of a problem that these x, y, and z are not individual numbers, but 2 by 2 matrices. So there is actually a solution to this. So there's a function called tensor dot that will do exactly this. So I'm just going to demonstrate it now, but we are going to talk about it sometime next week. And you can see that this actually works, and it does this what you thought this dot product should do. So again, we'll talk about this tensor dot function next week. So finally, we enter this matrix H, which I guess I forgot to say earlier, but this matrix has a name, which is commonly used, which is called the Hadamard matrix. And it's very frequently used in quantum computing. So that may be of interest. In any case, we can do our conjugation by H to get our matrices in new basis like this. And if we run it, we see that we get the 1, 0, 0, minus 1 for sigma x, this plus I in the upper right and minus I in the lower left for sigma y, and 0, 1, 1, 0 for sigma z, which is exactly what we found in the exercise earlier. So that's great. Everything is consistent. And this is what I wanted to get through today. So this is, I guess, the end of the class. I am going to stick around here for, 10 or 15 minutes. And I'm happy to answer questions you have left over from the day about the exercises, about the lecture, about, what we're going to be doing in the rest of the class. And otherwise, that's the end of class for today, and you're free to go, and I'll see you on Thursday. So.